Good morning. Hawaii's top industry finishes talking to itself today. Hawaii Tourism Authority CEO and President George Seghetti joins us with the key takeaways from a conference that's not business as usual. And as Hawaii celebrates two national blue ribbon schools and AP students outpacing national gains, a Wallet Hub study says Hawaii is the most unfriendly state for teachers. We'll find out why. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Irie Love's career as a reggae artist has taken her all over the world. She's back home in Kailua with a Waikiki performance and a new album, We Rise. And the custodians of one of Hawaii's historic sites remind us why preservation is so important.
It's Thursday, September 29th. That's The Conversation coming up right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Thinking about what it's like to be a teacher in Hawaii. This is something we've had cause to consider from time to time, isn't it?
And we've got cause to consider it today, too. And we've had some sort of a good news, not so good news
exactly,
story. Let's start with the good news first. Now, this week, Hawaii got the news that the performance of AP students exceeded national gains. And we also heard that two schools, Noalani Elementary School in Manoa and Helimano Elementary School in Whitmore Village, made the list of National Blue Ribbon Schools. This week, Hawaii teachers also got some not-so-good news. According to the economic data aggregator site Wallet Hub, Hawaii is the place where teachers are shortchanged the most. Jill Gonzalez is Wallet Hub's spokesperson, and she joins us now. Good morning. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back.
Let's talk first about how you looked at the information that gave us the worst ranking of all the states in terms of, you know, teacher friendliness, economically speaking. What did you look at?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of issues plaguing the teaching profession, but we really looked at metrics from a teacher's perspective. So we looked at two main categories. The first, job opportunity and competition. So that, of course, encompasses salaries, both starting and median annual. We looked at income growth potential there, the pensions, teacher demand, and we also looked at the 10-year change in teacher salaries to see how much or really how little that has changed in certain states. And then secondly, we looked at the academic and work environment, so not only the school system itself, but the teacher effectiveness, the pupil-to-teacher ratio, and school safety, which course, with recent events, is definitely important.
How did you weight those? I would imagine that some were weighted more than others.
Right. So most were given a full weight. Certain ones were given a triple weight, like the school system itself. You know, how are students doing there? What are test scores and AP test scores like? And some were only given half weight when we're looking at working parents' conditions and things like that.
When we look at Hawaii just from the teacher's perspective economically, we've heard for a very long time that many teachers feel disadvantaged, that they feel that they really aren't on par with other teachers in the nation, and that they continue to give out of their own pockets. And certainly nobody goes into teaching to make money. I mean, that's a given. People do it because they feel called to do it. Many have also felt called to drop out because they can't make it economically. What do you tell them to take away from this, which seems to validate so many of their feelings?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, across the country, not just in Hawaii, education jobs are still some of the lowest paying occupations that you still need a bachelor's degree for, so you have to shell out money for that, of course. And salaries consistently fail to keep up with inflation here. And when you're living in somewhere or someplace like Hawaii that has a little bit higher of a cost of living, that, of course, hits you that much harder. So I think that that's something that really local officials need to take a look at, especially with an election coming up. to hopefully put some programs in place here to not only get teachers to Hawaii, but make sure that they stay there or at least stay within the profession.
You brought up the issue of bringing teachers to Hawaii. We know that we have a teacher shortage, teachers who will come here from elsewhere believing that they're having this, you know, maybe a Hawaii adventure, but then they can't stay here because they can't afford to stay here. We hear those stories quite a bit. As you look at this data, which goes just beyond what teachers are making, are there brighter spots that might be something that would keep a teacher in the teaching profession or perhaps give somebody the encouragement to become a teacher?
Yeah, I mean, it was not all bad for Hawaii. There were certainly some spots where they did do better. First of all, there are safe schools there, and that's, again, from a teacher's perspective. So we looked at the percentage of public school teachers who reported that they were threatened with injury by a student from school within the past year or so. In Hawaii, that generally does not happen too often, so that at least is very good. Also, in terms of teacher effectiveness, we looked for states that require student growth in a teacher evaluation or at least are looking toward that, which is the case in Hawaii.
We had, as I mentioned in the opening, some good news this week about how AP students are doing, and also that we had two schools ranked on the national list of Blue Ribbon schools. Those are helpful points, but it still goes back to the point that teachers are putting out for their students because of the love of teaching and the love of students. Is there a point where you think where teachers may have to accept that maybe they're not going to be able to be paid as they would in other states? Because we keep hearing these same kinds of arguments over and over again, even with a study like yours that aggregated a great deal of economic data.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as far as the average starting salary, Hawaii came in at the lowest. This is adjusted for cost of living at around $24,000 a year. And when we're looking at the annual median salary, it really does not get too much higher. It increases around $10,000. That, again, was the lowest. When it comes to pensions, of course, I would think that would be a bigger deal in Hawaii. If you're staying there, if you're retiring there, that was also the lowest in the country, just around $9,000. So certainly not getting into it for the money. But it's interesting in Hawaii is that public school enrollment has not grown over the past year or so. It's actually decreased by almost 5%. We might see that a little bit more, too, in which case teachers will not be as high in demand in the future.
That's not necessarily a good sign, because that also means that perhaps younger families aren't able to stay in Hawaii either, and we've already seen a great deal of outflow. This seems to be giving yet another reason for that. But if you were to compare Hawaii at dead last in this way to, for example, Michigan, which was first, what do they do that you think we should be?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with, A, the 10-year change in salaries certainly does help, but getting away from money, looking at things like a smaller pupil-to-teacher ratio. In Hawaii, it's a little on the high side at around 16, 17 students for every one teacher. So that also disadvantages not only the teacher, but the students, right, not getting that attention that they might need. So things like that, really looking at a teacher's needs, would really help.
Well, even with all of that, knowing at least that we had some good news this week with the way some schools have been able to operate, still goes back to that point that a good teacher is going to be a good teacher is going to be a good teacher, perhaps even if he or she feels economically disadvantaged. But there may come a point where everybody has a breaking point and that good teacher may simply outplace. Thanks so much for all the information.
Anytime.
Good to talk to you again. Jill Gonzalez is the spokesperson for Wallet Hub. Her take on consumer finance issues have been featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Kiplinger. And at 8:13, you're listening to The Conversation on Statewide Member-Supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a bigger step into reggae for a Kailua-born singing star. First, here's your backyard quiz.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukahoolabe, uhawai.
In today's backyard quiz, we have a lesson in lei making, but you won't be using flowers. We're looking for the name of a berry found on a native citrus tree that grows in wet forests of a certain Hawaiian island. The leathery, maroon-colored berries are strung into lei for special occasions and were once used as the base for a popular Hawaiian perfume. The anise-scented fruit must be strung within a few hours of picking, and the resulting lei can be worn by both men and women. So what is the Hawaiian name for this versatile berry, and on which island does it grow? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Aloha, I'm Teresa Donnelly from Hawaii Military Pets. You're tuned in to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Fire is blazing. Ain't no time to waste, no more waiting. Fire, this ain't no hell we're raising. But we gotta burn it all down. Start rearranging. Down in my soul, I know the love is all we need. Love is a key.
Reggae performers are true believers. For them, the music is far more than a sound. It's a way of life and a spiritual way of being. Irie Love was immersed in the tradition growing up here in Hawaii. She came to local people's attention as a 1999 Brown Bags to Stardom competitor. She's grown since then into a successful touring and recording artist who's back home for a Waikiki show and with a new album called We Rise. She's on the phone with us from her home. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, of course.
And welcome home.
Thank you.
Do you have any time to spend at home after your gig tonight?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I'm always on the go, so it's good. I enjoy what I do, so that's a blessing.
Have you adapted pretty well to being always on the go?
Yeah, I have. I mean, I grew up, my grandmother was a travel agent, and my mother was 17 when she had me. So my grandma was kind of a second mom, and I would travel a lot with her from probably 3-4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So I've kind of had that traveling as a part of my life, even before I started singing professionally. So
well,
it's comfortable for me. It's fun.
Yeah, that helps a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
You know, I was leading into our talk by sort of talking about reggae as a way of life because it really does seem to be much more than a musical style for the people who are in that world. Does it seem that way to you?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like reggae is one of the few genres that we have that really has a platform for change. I think that was kind of the derivative of the whole the movement that started with reggae.
Yeah.
And so I think that kind of still shines through today, which is really great that we still have this platform in music that is kind of a way to express, you know, current events, things that are going on, and really empower people. So I love that part of the genre, and that was definitely why I was really drawn to it.
When it first came out, or when, you know, musicians up here became aware of it in the 70s, it really was closely tied. You know, it had a deceptively appealing beat with a message that was frequently about revolution, social change, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. I had the privilege of being in a documentary that was just recently released by a film crew from London who did a whole, I think it was a few years that they took filming different celebrities and different people about the band Steel Pulse from London.
Sure.
Or from Birmingham, I believe. And I had the opportunity to perform with them when I was a teenager here in Hawaii. And they were one of the first bands that I really listened to and grew up on. And their message and movements and melodies were just so unique for the whole genre of reggae. But they were definitely in that movement of being revolutionaries and using the music to speak change and empower the people. So, yeah, it's definitely a huge part of the sound. I mean, it's still about love, and you know, there's love songs and different lighter subject matters as well. But that's definitely like the catalyst of the whole genre is revolution.
Which is kind of remarkable given its origins in, you know, a small, relatively small Caribbean island.
Yeah, definitely.
There are other movements for social change, but this is one that caught on and spread around the world. I've always thought that was kind of amazing.
Yeah, I mean, Bob Marley, you know, we just definitely have to give our respect to him. He was a huge person that really stood out and took the music to another level. I think that, you know, even today, his music is so timeless. You know, there's still kids that are coming up today in this whole world of technology and this, you know, overconsumption of information where you can literally find anything at your fingertips at any moment because of technology, which is amazing. And we're living in an amazing time, but it's definitely a telltale sign when there's kids who grow up in that are still drawn to the music of people like Bob Marley or even Marvin Gaye, you know, people that came up in that time when there really was a lot of social injustice happening worldwide. And for that to still stand today and be a message that is carried over all these years, I think speaks volumes for the genre.
You know, I was driving into Chicago in the summer of 1970, which was always a source of some tension for young people at the time. And it's the first time I heard What's Going On by Marvin Gaye on the radio. And you can imagine at that place and time how that was just a summation of everything. It was sort of a moment to me that indicated how powerful music can be. It's remarkable that it's lasted this long. Yeah.
I mean, give me chicken skin with you just saying that. I mean, that's such a powerful song. I think, you know, that's one of the main reasons that I've continued to do music is because of that one factor of how it causes an emotion in people. It causes people to feel something and to think differently, and it can wake people up. It can empower them. I mean, that's really what causes me to be able to carry through the trials and tribulations of being in the music industry, because it's definitely not an easy road. But to be able to use a platform like music to really, you know, help people, really, just by, you know, getting in the studio, recording something and releasing it, is such an amazing gift to be able to have the opportunity to do that in my lifetime.
Well, as a performer, you know what happens when a group of people start locking together, singing along to the chorus of a song, right?
Yeah, definitely.
That's a pretty powerful impact to have on people. You know, you don't get that quite as easily by making a speech, do you?
Right. There's something about music. I remember reading a while back about how melody and lyric or words combined kind of sticks in your brain and activates your brain in a different way, which is why, you know, we grow up singing the ABCs or, you know, nursery rhymes, things that we are trying to learn at these developmental stages are combined with melody because it allows the brain to really receive it in a different way. So that speaks a lot about what music can really do to you.
Well, it certainly taps into that part of the brain that controls feelings and not just information, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's
so awesome.
I think with artists that you talked about, people like Bob Marley and Marvin Gaye, it becomes a sense of mission. It's not just hitting notes anymore. It's way beyond
that.
Do you think that's happening with you?
Yeah. I started a mission or a movement called Empower the Youth about 7 years ago. And I've been working with the Boys and Girls Club. And in the recent years, I've been working with the Mana Maoli Project, which is a local project here that has now expanded into the Mana Mele Project. We got some federal funding to build a mobile studio and do mentorship programs at charter schools all over the islands. And now I've officially become a music teacher for this semester at Halau Kumana, really being able to get in with the kids and use music and give them the gift and help them to cultivate the gift of music to empower them. Mm-hmm. So I definitely feel like that's a huge part of what I do. I mean, to be able to watch the music come full circle, because I started when I was 16 at Brown Bags to Stardom at Kalaheo High School in Kailua. And, you know, I think at the time, I ended up singing a song that was from the Sister Act movie. Lauryn Hill sang a classic gospel song called His Eyes on the Sparrow. And I chose to sing that song because I was most comfortable singing Christian songs and gospel songs because I would sing in church. That was the only time I would really perform. And so I chose to sing that song, and you know, the rest is history. I ended up winning, and the rest is history. But, you know, that song has a message. You know, His Eye is on the Sparrow.
Yes, it does.
The message is, you know, that even the smallest person, the smallest little tiny bird is being watched over by this higher power. And that really, whatever you believe in, if you are religious or spiritual or not at all, just really the message of it doesn't matter who you are, how small you feel you are. Everyone has a significance. We're all here for a special purpose. And so this program with Mana Mele has kind of given me a chance to go in and have that one-on-one interaction with the kids and be able to speak that to them, that message to them through my music. So
you know what, Irie, that's also going to deepen your music because it'll deepen you.
Oh, absolutely. It already has.
No, I'm sure it has. Thank you so much for talking with us this morning. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Irie Love will perform tonight at Blue Note Hawaii in Waikiki, and her new CD is We Rise. You can find out more about her on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Here's a fact. The monthly gifts from HPR sustaining members make a huge impact. And if you've been listening for a while, you know that. You've seen that over the past few years, the goals for every pledge drive have steadily decreased. So don't wait. Make your public radio station thrive with steady, predictable income. Pledge $10 a month or more by calling us at 955-8821 or become a sustaining member at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thank you so much.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Surveys were on our minds today. We just talked about the Wallet Hub's latest economic assessment for teachers earlier in the show. And surveys are also tools that labor unions, special interest groups, and the media are using to gauge candidate understanding and positions on issues. For today's reality check, Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a survey roundup. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
It seems like there are more surveys this time around and that candidates are being asked to really communicate more. Is that so, or is that just sort of a myth?
it's somewhat anecdotal, but I've actually looked at these surveys before, and Nathan Eagle in his story today suggests that, boy, there do seem to be more than ever. I'll just give you three examples. The National Rifle Association wants to know how our candidates, and I mean local, stand on a state law that we passed on gun owners being in a federal database, a very controversial bill. A Planned Parenthood wants to know how you feel about abstinence-only education in schools. Do you oppose that? Do you support that? One other example, the Democratic Party of Hawaii wants to know how you feel about same-sex couples having access to fertility options. Now, these are all important things for voters to find out, but we're hearing from candidates who feel bombarded. There seems to be more than ever, and it actually takes a great deal of time to fill out all these surveys.
Now, you might wonder if so many surveys are coming their way to ask them about specific issues, that maybe perhaps that might mean that the candidates kind of on their own have not been communicating effectively or as effectively as they should to be able to already answer these questions.
Right. And, the reason why they feel pressure is, well, people may vote for you or against you, depending on how you stand on a certain situation. You may get money, you may get endorsements or not. I'll give you the reactions of a couple of the lawmakers that Nathan talked to. Carl Rhodes, he's a House rep. He's running for the Senate now. He says he's not going to fill out the ones that are from groups that are for tobacco, right? Pro-tobacco or pro-gun lobbyists. That's not his interest at all. He says, you know what? It actually might be better just to go knock on doors in your district and sine wave. That may be a more effective way. One other, Kaniela Ng there on Maui, a representative, he says, yeah, I think it's important to know where I stand on TMT on Mauna Kea or water rights for farmers, but there's a whole bunch of other issues out there that just may not be of wide appeal.
Which means that they're going to cherry pick and somebody's going to make something of the fact that they're not answering a particular survey or questionnaire.
Well, that's exactly the fear. Imagine the NRA puts out information saying, oh, we're giving this candidate an F, this candidate an A. And clearly that could sway some voters in a district. And that's one of the concerns folks have.
Which, again, goes back to a lot of pressure on candidates to have to truly get out there and communicate their positions and be in touch with their districts. Hey, thanks so much.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Talk to you soon. Every day we bring you a reality check with Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair. If there's one thing we all know about living in Hawaii, it's the importance of tourism. This week, the Hawaii Tourism Authority has been holding what it says is the world's best conference on tourism. It's featuring a changed format, more interactivity, and shared best practices. And perhaps even more important, there are global partners, including China, who are participating for the first time. The conference wraps today, and we were curious about the takeaways this year as the tourism market keeps refining itself to optimize growth and visitor experience. George Segetti is the president and CEO of the Hawaii Tourism Authority. He's in our studio this morning. Good morning. Thanks for making time in a very, very busy schedule.
Good morning, Beth Ann. It's an honor and privilege to be here, so thank you very much for having me.
As we look at tourism in Hawaii, one of the biggest questions that has been going on for a very, very long time is what truly is the carrying capacity of Hawaii? Has this been at all discussed this time around, especially as you have so many new partners?
It actually has. It's a big part. What we're trying to do is really find the balance between the visitor needs and the visitors coming in, which is our economic engine, find that balance of what's going to be compatible with our natural resources and compatible with our residents. It's very, very important with what we with our strategic plan.
Early in the week, we were talking about the Outdoor Circle on Hanama Bay and looking at what just is the carrying capacity of that area. But in general, as you are having conversations with partners, with people who may be coming here for the very first time, the difference about Hawaii as opposed to other places is the cultural sensitivity that we hopefully impart in some ways to people as they come. But that's also a very different question when you're talking about people understanding respect. That's one of those fuzzy areas that's hard to be able to communicate. As you are talking about this so much in the industry and have brought in so many cultural practitioners this time and looking at the issue of culture, how do you begin to get that across to visitors and to partners who are looking to bring people to Hawaii?
It's a really good question, and it's been a big part. We have 60 tracks being really relevant tracks being presented this week, and we're really looking for open dialogue and interaction between the stakeholders. And we have 10 sessions alone on Hawaiian culture. That's how important it is to us. As I've traveled these past 16 months, we do know that it's important that we recognize, embrace, and perpetuate the Hawaiian culture. It's the pillar that we stand. It's embedded in everything we do. So we're trying to do through these cultural programs is make sure that our contractors worldwide understand how important it is to us to have the authentic Hawaiian culture represented. And I think we're getting that message through. I'm getting really good feedback. We had Senator Galateria be one of our moderators. We had Corbett Kalama. We had just outstanding tracks on Hawaiian culture, and I've been getting good feedback.
As you are having this dialogue, there's also the public component, and that would mean being able to get feedback from the public, too, and also bring them into the conversation. After 9/11, there seemed to be a really big push to have everybody understand the importance of tourism. And there seemed to be this full embrace of tourism as Hawaii's lead industry. And now as we've watched over the past 5 years with growth year over year that just seemed to be, can't go any higher, there seems to be this idea that, well, maybe, you know, tourism is more over there than part of who we are as a state, which encompasses everybody. How do you start to bridge that gap where maybe there may be some even resentments because of the fact that the tourism is doing so well?
That's a complex question because it involves so many things. It's really, even in my opening speech, I said that we really need to find the balance between our visitor needs and expectations and that get that balance to our natural resources, but also to our residents. Technology, is changing the tourism model day by day in that, they go on their smartphones now and they see where locals hike and locals eat and locals swim because the new visitor is really looking for authenticity in their travel. And so those will be challenges because we also want to teach or get the message out to our travelers to have, you know, that respect and where they're going. They're going to uncharted territories right now for us, and we need as...
And possibly somebody's neighborhood.
Yes, and so we're trying, and that's what the part of our mission during this conference is to have really all of us talk and how do we address this. Regulation hasn't kept up with technology, and technology is throwing challenges at us every single day, all the way from Uber and traditional transportation
and
with
Airbnb,
cabs and
we've
Airbnb
been hearing
and alternative.
A lot about that this week.
Exactly, to traditional brick and mortar. All of this is technology. They're platforms. They're just platforms. I mean, but they're based on demand, so they're here to stay. So our challenge in bringing everybody together and having this collaboration and discussions is identifying these challenges and how do we bring everybody in together and make this work.
You bring up the issue of technology. You also bring up the idea of bringing people together, the fact that people are accessing so much more information because they can. We've got the technology to be able to do that, and that's changing. You're also having to compete at that level with your own app and being able to send out various messages that would be perhaps targeted to certain groups. We've heard a lot this week about don't forget the LGBT tourist. All of that. How are you sort of assimilating all this information in looking at your first generation app and what we'll see perhaps in future?
Well, we're getting this. In fact, today is going to be a lot about technology, where we're introducing our app that we have. As far as you can put it in as soon as you get here, our app is interesting in that we were expecting 10,000 people to come online with our app, and we actually had 20,000 people come put our app onto their phone. And those apps are in all languages. And it's also a vehicle that we can give safety messages to the visitors when they come here now. So it'll have alerts if something happens. God forbid, a tsunami's coming. But we can now alert people. And we also give safety messages of, swim where there's lifeguards and things like that. So that's one. Then we're up. And then we have the virtual reality, which we're going to be launching today, as well as facial recognition program that we have with Expedia. This is all technology. It's cutting leading edge. But again, we're competing globally for visitors, and it's important that we stay ahead, that we stay cutting edge, and that we do not get complacent.
Of all the things that you've seen this time around, where you've had an extended time and you have another day and a half today and tomorrow until the conference wraps, is there something that you're really seeing this year in such a pronounced different way than you have when you've had other conferences that have been a couple of days where there's been a lot of data sharing but not a whole lot of discussion about some of those other issues that you've just talked about that are squarely human and human user based?
Oh, that's been I've been really, really pleased with the amount of people coming up to me and just saying this is by far and away the best conference we've ever had, in that in the past we would do a day and a half conference and we would come up and just talk at you. Here's the numbers, we're up, we're down.
So what are the big takeaways?
The big takeaways is there's just much more open collaboration and there's voice. We ask them, we want to hear you, and we want to hear your voice. We want you to be engaged. We're all stakeholders, and it's important that we all come together in protecting.
Was there anyone you didn't hear from who you would like to?
No, I've been really pleased with the amount of people coming up. We had 2,000 people, over 2,000 people come. So.
Well, you look like a very happy person these days, and good to talk to you today. We'll chat with you again, and good luck with the rest of the conference.
Thank you very much, Beth Ann.
George Saghetti is President and Chief Executive Officer of the Hawaii Tourism Authority. HTA's job is to strategically manage the state of Hawaii's marketing initiatives to support tourism. The industry has been meeting this week and wraps it up tomorrow with the largest HTA conference to date.
Aloha and good morning. This is Ted Tsukiyama. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
And tonight at 5, Beth Ann, you'll be bringing us Town Square. And, we've been hearing from a number of journalists that covering this presidential race is tricky in a number of ways that journalism hadn't really had to deal with before.
And, we had lots of conversation about that at the conference that I just attended. And this is a big issue for everybody. It's also a really big issue for consumers. And, of course, we've heard from a lot of people, too, who are happy or unhappy with the way media has been handling this race. And, of course, we know this election is like no other. So tonight we're going to take that on with not the journalists, but the editors, those who are in their own way shaping some of this conversation. And Civil Beat editor and general manager Patty Epler will be here. Also Hawaii News Now news director Mark Platt will join us. And we're going to look at it from a local perspective, but looking at something that even though Hawaii may have limited ability to affect the presidential outcome, this is deeply important to people, and we've heard that over this election more so than any other.
Well, it's an election is so much affected by the way it's covered, so this will be a really interesting discussion. Thanks, Bethany.
We hope so. Tonight at 5, plan to join us right here.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you
want to
do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. For today's show, I hit the books. Here's what I found. According to a recent Gallup poll, in the last decade, an average of 83% of the American population made some sort of charitable donation each year. People in Hawaii and those in the mainland appear generally to support the same types of causes, but there are two major differences. On the mainland, people give 12% to support human services, but here in Hawaii, that number is up to 31%. The greatest difference between them and us is 32% of all mainland giving goes to support religions, while in Hawaii, we allocate only 4% of our total giving to churches. These next numbers may come as a real surprise. The environment, without which nothing else matters, receives only 6% of giving on the mainland. And here at home, in the endangered species capital of the world, we give only 4% to preserve the earth, our home. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
And in case you've been waiting with bated breath for the answer to today's backyard quiz, well, wait no longer. Here you go. Now, today we took you along for some berry picking. We were hoping to find a maroon-colored berry used in lei making that can only be found on one of the Hawaiian islands. Because it can only be found on that island, the berry in question is often used to represent its island of origin. Typical of so many native Hawaiian flora, today's answer has multiple uses. It's beautiful and symbolic, but it also smells good. The anise-scented twigs and berries of the parent tree were once placed between the folds of tapa cloth for their pleasant fragrance. That tree is the Mokihana tree, and that's also the answer to today's quiz. It's the Mokihana berry, which is found only on the Garden Isle of Kauai.
And Beth Ann, Larry Rose of Miloli'i knew the answer. Congratulations, Larry. And at 8:48, that's today's quiz. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
The Daughters of Hawaii, since their founding in 1903, have taken their mission of historic and cultural preservation seriously as custodians to sites that include Hanaya Kamalama or the Queen Emma Summer Palace. Back in 1915, the Daughters saved the palace from being bulldozed to make way for a baseball field, and they've been hanging on tight to it ever since. Their 40th annual day at Queen Emma Summer Palace is this Saturday, and Mahea Bernal is on the line to tell us more. Good morning, Mahea.
Aloha kakahiaka, Chris.
You know, I had forgotten that story about the baseball field, but that must have been quite the drama back in the day.
Oh, yes, it was. It was very much the drama that when the Daughters of Hawaii had made inquiries about Queen Emma's home, there was such publicity and a community following in order that they would push through with a petition to the Hawaiian government to receive Hanaya Kamalama as part of an agreement and to become the custodians of it, as we still are today.
Yeah, but it's sort of it's a drama that kind of indicates how important historic preservation is, yeah?
Yes, it is. In fact, the Daughters of Hawaii, they had the foresight to see the potential loss of the Hawaiian culture, the music, and the language. A lot of Western and European influences had come into the Hawaiian kingdom, and by that time, at the turn of the 20th century in 1903, when they formed, they knew that if they did not do something to preserve the culture and to perpetuate it, and then 10, 15 years later to preserve and keep Hanaya Kamalama Queen Emma Summer Palace, all would have been lost.
You know, it's always amazed me, Mahea, that when a new culture comes into an area, that it feels the need to sort of act like an invasive plant and you know, take all the soil from every other form of culture. Yeah.
Yes, that's very true. And what is unique about the Daughters of Hawaii, the founders, they were born in the 19th century, anywhere between 1844 and 1850, and these women were descendants of American Protestant missionaries, and so they were familiar with the culture. They knew the people in their community. They were living under the reign of the monarchy, and they had an understanding of its importance. And so to seek out to preserve it was very important to them. And they've done a great job, and we have continued through the decades, over a century of the work that was started back by our original founders in 1903.
Mahea, do you continue to feel support out there?
Yes, we do. It's a support that comes from the local community, our Kama'aina. It's support that comes from around the world. We have many members of Daughters of Hawaii who have come on board for the purpose of historic preservation from different parts of the world. And we do have support, and we are grateful for the support that we receive, but it's always great to have more people come on board, you know, when they understand what the organization does and the importance of historic preservation of these cultural sites in the 21st century.
Does the Hanaia Kamalama continue to be popular with visitors?
Yes, very popular, especially with our heritage visitors who are seeking out an authentic place, a cultural place, an authentic experience, and to have the opportunity to walk into the home of a once ruling monarch, the queen, and the king of the Hawaiian kingdom.
What kind of questions do visitors ask when they come for a visit?
Well, when they come in for a visit, they first ask us, where's the house from? Because so many of our visitors, especially from the States, they take a look at the home and they recognize that this is an architectural style that they are familiar with, especially if they come from the East Coast.
Yeah.
So they ask where the home is from. And then the second question they ask is, did the Queen really live here? And the third question they ask, is everything real?
And it's that predictable. I mean, you could break it down to 1, 2, 3, the questions they ask you.
Exactly. Because to many of our visitors, they're not aware that places such as Hanaia Kamalama Queenama Summer Palace still exist today. And, you know, it is a remnant of the Hawaiian kingdom and the Hawaiian monarchy.
Well, and certainly when they ask about the architectural style, they're seeing a building that could easily crop up in Massachusetts or Vermont, yeah?
Very much so. It is a style that is very popular along the eastern seaboard, up in Massachusetts, Vermont, Washington, D.C. It is done in the Greek Revival architectural style. So many, as I had mentioned earlier, many who come from the East Coast, they look at the home and they know this home has come from somewhere, and they take a guess. Has it come from Boston? Which it did. It came from Boston.
That's pretty good, isn't it? But it must be kind of surprising to them to see, you know, I'm not sure what they would expect on a visit to a Hawaiian queen's summer palace, but it probably wouldn't be New England East Coast architecture, would it?
Exactly. It is the least of what they're expecting. You know, some people have actually said to our docent staff, we thought we were going to come to a house made of grass.
I knew it. I knew you were going to say that, yeah. A grass shack.
Grass shack. And so they're very surprised that this home is not a grass shack.
Well, I would imagine if they're surprised by that, a lot of other things about the story of the monarchy and of the queen herself would also surprise them, yeah?
Yes, very much so. This is a part of history that many visitors are not familiar with. They simply are not aware. They have not been taught that at one time in our history there was a king and a queen who ruled a Hawaiian kingdom. And so that in itself is the intrigue, and it stirs their curiosity. And so they want to know, well, tell us about this queen. Who was she? Who was her husband? What did they do?
The whole, and also the relationship of the monarchy to the missionary community must be a revelation as well.
Yes, it is. It is very much so. When the missionaries arrived in the 1820s, they brought with them, you know, wonderful things. And in fact, the founders of our organization happen to be descendants of American missionaries. And so one of the things that our visitors are very surprised to know is that our kings and queens, about 16, 17 of them, were chosen by Kamehameha III, Queen Emma being one of them, and her husband, Alexander Viholiho Ioleni, who would become Kamehameha IV.
Mahea, we have to go. Our show's come to an end. Thank you so much for talking with us. Mahea Bernal is one of the organizers of the Daughters of Hawaii's 40th Annual Day at Queen Emma Summer Palace. Runs from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Saturday at the Palace on Pali Highway in Honolulu. And you can find out more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. Interesting, Bethann, to hear the reaction of visitors to a visit to the Queen Emma Summer Palace.
And what's not to like,
exactly,
in going there? It's beautiful. But interesting, too, to hear what George Zagetti said earlier, that there really isn't an identified caring capacity for Hawaii, because you're talking about headroom. And the question is, what does that headroom really look like, both for Oahu and certainly for the neighbor islands? Going to be really interesting. That's going to do it for us, though, for this day. Tomorrow we'll be back with you, and we're going to take a look at the construction forecast with Carl Bonham.
And we're going to look inside Hawaii's first Music and Multimedia Academy.
Meanwhile, give us your thoughts on our talk back line. It's 808-792-8217, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or say hello to me at BKOZHPR.
You can find past shows under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkoek.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. I'll see you for Town Square later, and we'll both be back tomorrow morning with more of The Conversation. See you then.